Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is a lovely July 7th, 2003. Today's session is Hospitality on the U.S.-Mexico Border, a session with Margaret Sawyer. The number is SAM2003-01. Let's listen in.
My name's Margaret Sawyer. I've been in the village for a month, and I'm leaving tomorrow and working in the kitchen. And I came straight here from the past 20 months, which I've been living in El Paso, Texas, in a house of hospitality about 10 blocks north of the border with Juarez. And it's been, being in Holden has been just exactly what I was hoping it would be, kind of a time to be reflecting on my experiences on the border and be thinking about my next stop. I'm going to Divinity School in the fall, but also a time just to be sharing with people about what life is like there and the work that's going on for a lot of people on the border. And it's been really exciting to get to talk about it, so I'm excited to get to do this session tonight. I thought I'd start off just by describing a little bit of the house and talking sort of about the history and who comes to the house and where they go from after they pass through our house usually. And then if people have questions at the end, we can do that too. And if you have questions during the talk too, that's fine. I'm passing around a photo album that has a lot of pictures from kind of all jumbled up from over the 20 months that I was there. And one section of them you'll notice is kind of a series about a young man who was killed while he was at our house, killed by the Border Patrol in February of this year. There's a few other highlights of a little baby that I got to see being born who stayed at our house and some other things, but you'll see it in the photo album. It's kind of just going around. The place where I was called Annunciation House, and it was part of an organization, its own little organization right on the border. There was our house, which was considered the emergency shelter, and we were the original house in the organization, also called Annunciation House. And there was another house in El Paso called Casa Vitas, which was for people who were working on fixing papers. And I don't know how familiar people are with the process, but it's a really slow process. Almost any form of immigration proceedings is very slow. We did a lot of work with people applying for asylum or a law called VAWA, which is Violence Against Women Act. It's for women who've married abusive American husbands, and they're undocumented, and it's a way for them to self-petition for their own papers. So we had two houses in El Paso and two in Juarez. One was a shelter just for women and children, and one was kind of a house of accompaniment in a really poor area in Juarez that had sprung up after the American factories opened on the Juarez side of the border in the early 90s. So we were kind of a spread-out organization, but pretty focused right in El Paso. And I was at the emergency shelter, which we had usually about 50 to 60 people staying there a night. We had space for around 25 men, 12 women, and 6 families. The idea was that we accepted the people who had no other options. We tried to be pretty careful when we did an intake on someone to make sure that they weren't just coming to us because, you know, they fought with their sister and couldn't stay there anymore. If people had other places that they could stay, we tried to ask them to be there just to save the bed space. But usually the option list meant undocumented people in El Paso because the other main shelters, like the Salvation Army, would only accept people if they were documented. And we were open to anyone who just needed a place to stay. So the house was run by 4 to 7 volunteers usually at a time. Most people came for a year commitment. We also had a 10-week summer program. And we all lived together at the house, the volunteers and the guests. And everything at the house, the entire organization is run completely on donations because any money from the federal government comes with usually the string attached that papers be checked and people's documentation be proved before services are provided. So everything that we use, people would come over all the time. You'll see pictures of huge bags of clothes and food being brought to the house a lot, and people donated cars and money, and it was amazing. It was sort of like the whole city of El Paso kind of kept the houses going. So The house started in the late 70s when a group of young people were trying to figure out how to best follow the Gospels. They were mostly people working in the Catholic diocese in youth education, and they were meeting every Thursday night kind of for like a informal, from what I've gathered, informal Bible study, and trying to, I think, probably discuss liberation theology and how they could incorporate the idea of what was becoming to be known as the preferential option for the poor. That was a big thing discussed and the growth of liberation theology, how they could incorporate that into their own work, how they could be living among the poor and working among the poor, and what did that mean exactly, the poor. They slowly got the idea that they wanted to move into an area in the city that was known as the poorer area, and they were able to talk to the Catholic diocese and get part of the building that we now lived in donated. They just moved in and they weren't really sure what was going to happen next, but slowly from living there, a young guy, I guess, was looking for a place to stay and was referred to them. He'd been a prostitute in California and he was only 16 and couldn't stay in any other shelters because he was too young, and he came to live with them. And from there, more and more people were referred to live with them, and they started realizing that their goal was going to be a house of hospitality. We talked a lot about what hospitality meant exactly and how that was going to work, and kind of how hospitality can be providing a safe space, providing good food, providing a comfortable place for people to be, but also providing a really respectful environment where everybody was treated pretty equally, and we demanded that of the guests too, that people be treated with respect. There were some people, especially women, who came to us who I think had never really been treated very well, and it was a real surprise for them to have everyone be asking them their opinions on things and offering them different jobs to do and really giving them their own space. We talked about hospitality being providing people to like a space to sort of be discovering their own, working on their own things, working on their own themselves or whatever they needed to be thinking about. So we also tried to, we talked a lot about solidarity, how to live among the guests and what that meant. We had a lot of struggles with that. Most of us came from college-educated backgrounds. We were coming down typically to do sort of a year of service, or some people thought of it kind of as, you know, their volunteer year. Some people, too, thought of it as just sort of an ongoing supporting this house that was there. But either way, it was hard to figure out how to fully be living in solidarity with the guests and to what level that was appropriate. There were definitely rooms in the house that were locked, but the volunteers had the keys. We lived there, but our rooms locked and the guest rooms didn't. We enforced certain rules on the guests that we didn't enforce on ourselves, like a curfew, a 10 o'clock curfew. So that was always an interesting question, but also trying to figure out how to really put ourselves in the space where we could be trying to live with what people were dealing with, trying to be talking about and feeling the things that were going on for them. In the history of the house, during the 80s, late 70s and most of the 80s, it sounds like, the house was really responding to the need for Central Americans coming north for sort of a sanctuary space. We at times had up to 100 or 120 people living in the house who were all from Central America. We wouldn't accept Mexicans during that time. Any Mexican was asked to stay in our house in Juarez, just to please to cross back across the border, stay there, you know, do your work in El Paso, because the border was really nothing until the mid-90s. It was considered pretty easy to cross. So Central Americans stayed with us. There was a lot of work on trying to help people apply for asylum, because most of them were escaping political wars. Guatemala, Salvador, Nicaragua. It was really hard at that time, especially in the early 80s, for people to get asylum here because our government was funding a lot of the anti-communist work that was going on in those countries. So for the most part, we were funding armies that were fighting against land reform acts or against groups of peasants uniting in unions. And when those people came north looking for asylum, our government wouldn't offer it to them because we were paying for those wars. So a lot of people from our house at that time were going north to Canada. it changed a lot after peace settlements were made in those countries. More around the same time, it seems like that things started sort of slowing down. Less, fewer and fewer Central American refugees were coming for political asylum. NAFTA was passing in the early 90s, and also a new immigration policy is called Hold the Line. NAFTA affected a lot of Mexico because it's changed our, it's made more free trade, which allows American products to be sold in Mexico. A lot more people were coming north to the border to be working in the American factories. A lot of people weren't able to work on the farms that they've been working on for most of their life because, through their time, because American goods were so much cheaper to buy after NAFTA had started. So more Mexicans were looking to come north. Fewer Mexicans were able to continue working in the industries that they'd been in. And also at that time, it was getting harder for us to say things like, oh, please cross back and stay at our house in Juarez because we're full here with Central Americans because the...
Is Juarez in Mexico?
What's that?
Is Juarez in Mexico?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have said that. It's sort of like El Paso and Juarez. You can see right from one end to the other. When you're driving on the highway in El Paso, you can see the neighborhoods in Mexico. People would come north. NAFTA and also the INS policies were changing to make our border a lot more tightly controlled. There were different campaigns in different cities across the border. The one in El Paso was called Hold the Line, and it put a whole lot more funds into Border Patrol directly on the border, making... When you're driving in El Paso now, you notice that there's a Border Patrol car every 500 yards, and there's also lights, like stadium lights, across the border so that they can be watching. There's hundreds and millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and cameras that take pictures of people that are continuously photographing who's crossing anything that's going on the border. They have night vision goggles. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I'm having a difficult time following you.
I'm sorry, I was worried about this.
You're speaking very fast.
Okay.
You drop your voice. And so.
I don't do much public speaking, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll try to make it slower and less high pitched. Because I want people to be able to understand me. So when this policy was passed in 1994 that made the border more tight, it became a lot more difficult for people to cross. And all of those changes meant that our house was accepting more what we call economic refugees, more people coming from Mexico and fewer people from Central America. But there still are people from Central America who are coming to the house. So today, our house pretty much reflects that. We had about 70% Mexicans, 30% people from Central America, and always the stray Malaysians, a couple Russians. There was usually somebody with something interesting, interesting immigration situations staying at the house too. People came to us, they found out about our house a lot through word of mouth. There have been 60,000 people who stayed at Annunciation House in the past 25 years. So sometimes people would come from very far away and say, my next door neighbor stayed here 15 years ago when he came north to work in the cornfields in Kansas. He told me about your house. People would also come and just cross with no plans for what was going to happen next. They'd cross the border just with the shirt on their backs and no money. And people would tell them, people in El Paso would direct them to our house, sometimes even drive them over to our house. And we also got referrals from INS, from the Immigration and Naturalization Service. They would call us and often refer people to us who were in the middle of immigration proceedings and they weren't and needed a place to stay outside of the detention center. Or if they had a family that they were going to deport, they couldn't hold children in the detention center, so they would refer the parents and children, usually the mother and children, to stay with us and keep the father in detention. So people came to us in all sorts of ways. Typically, if they crossed the border, they went over the Rio Grande River or through it. Sometimes people paid someone to help them to cross the border. Sometimes people just seemed to know how to do it. They did it on their own knowledge. We didn't find out too much about that. We tried to stay very uninvolved in how people came to our house and how they were going to work out their next step. We were really there to have the door open for them, to have a safe place to be while they were in El Paso. A lot of people, during their time in our house, were trying to figure out how to go further north because they were coming with the purpose of making money for their families, almost always, and El Paso wasn't. I think it being called the pass is just such a sign of so many people coming through, so many immigrants working there, so many very poor labor policies in El Paso too, people getting paid really $80 a week to live in and do domestic work was pretty standard, 5 days a week for $80, or $25 a day to work 12 hours in construction. So people knew that people would go further north. People were also coming to our house, sometimes escaping bad situations in Mexico and trying to figure out what their next step would be, or bad situations in the U.S. We tried to just provide a space for people to kind of figure those things out. People stayed for really varying amounts of time. Sometimes families would be with us for a few months, individuals sometimes just for a week, a couple days before they moved on. People usually moved on by traveling on trains, on cargo trains. There's a lot of people who would hop cargo trains in the middle of the night and take those trains to Phoenix or Kansas. Those were big centers of work, Denver, California. And that was really dangerous. We had a girl who stayed with us over Christmas who had run away from her mother in Durango, Mexico. She was 16. She was trying to figure out what was going to happen next. We were helping her get in touch with her father. This was what seemed to be happening. She came and told us one night that she was going to leave on the train. And we sat down with her and said, "This, from what we know, this is really dangerous. You're overweight. You're really young. This is really a hard thing to do. Are you going to be able to do this?" She left. And 2 days later, there was an article in the paper saying that she'd lost her leg in the train and crossing. We were able to get in touch with her, but she's back in Mexico now, working with her mom. So people came to us for all kinds of reasons, and they went north for all kinds of reasons, but the thing that was really impactful to me about living in the house was just how much people were really coming from poverty, really hard situations, and were seeing the U.S. not as the place that was going to solve all their problems, or this dreamland that they were hoping to become part of so much as a place where they were coming to do some work, to earn some money, and hopefully to get back to their families soon. We did know some families who came north, especially families saying, "I want to put my children in American schools. The schools here are better. My children will get better health care here. I want to be here." But a lot of the people coming were coming for money to feed their families. It was really striking to me, all of those things, especially my parents came and visited, and my dad kind of gotten this revelation about these are all really good people, and they're just trying to get here, and we're setting up this really hard obstacle course for them to get here, and all they want to be doing is the work that we don't want to be doing. And that was really pretty clear from living at the house. We also had, as I mentioned, and as you'll see pictures of in the book, a young man was killed by Border Patrol while he was staying in our house. It was really common for people at our house to be deported. We even had a policy about it. If a person got deported one time, they could return to the house. If they were deported more than once, we started to be a little wondering if they really needed to be at our house or if there was something someplace else they could stay, wondering if the story was true. But this particular day, it was a Saturday morning in February, and the Border Patrol actually pulled into our driveway, which was really unusual because over time, they've pretty much set up a policy. It's not a law, but the head of Border Patrol in El Paso says that they have a policy of not trying to interfere with social service agencies. They don't go to elementary schools and check people's papers, any school. They don't bother churches. They don't bother hospitals. Those things, I think, are by law, and he's extended it as a policy to include social service agencies. So we rarely came into direct contact with Border Patrol. But this particular morning, they actually drove into our driveway and parked there. Juan was taking out the trash. His name was Juan Patricio. He was 19 years old. He was taking out the trash for the house, talking to some friends in our parking lot, and they asked him to see some papers. He was getting out his wallet and explaining that he didn't have any. They had him spread against the car when another volunteer came up and was asking them some questions. What are you doing here? What's going on? While they were distracted, he, being 19 and kind of impulsive in some ways, he decided to run, and he ran away from them. There was a few minutes, as I understand, that they couldn't find him. He picked up a long, about a 4 or 5 feet stick, and was holding it on his shoulder when they found him walking down the street. And from the reports that I've heard, there were about 17 witnesses to it, people in the street, people in buses, people in cars nearby, and a lot of people from our house who saw it happen from the roof. They were about 30 feet from him when they shot him and killed him, and shot him in the abdomen and in the upper arm.
Murder.
What's that?
Murder Act.
Mm-hmm. Murder Act.
Murder Act, right. That's how we felt about it. That afternoon, the Border Patrol chief came on the television immediately saying that it was provoked, that he had tried to beat one of the officers with this pole, that there had been a ladder he tried to throw at someone. There were no witnesses that we knew of that had testified to a ladder or him trying to actually beat someone with the pole. But there are things about it that are questionable. For us, it really felt like a whole new level of what was happening on the border. In some ways, it felt kind of like preemptive action, preemptive violence on a really small scale, Bush's preemptive strategies happening writ small. The next thing that happened immediately after was that the police came, detectives came to our house, talked to the 10 people who'd witnessed what had happened, and said, we'd like to take you to the police station for further questioning. We'll be able to do a more thorough investigation. Took these witnesses. The witnesses said, we're happy with that. We want, we volunteer to go with you. We said to the police officer, can you guarantee that these people will be returned to our house? Oh, I guarantee it. No problem, no problem. They went to the police station, and INS tried to deport them from the police station. Mm-hmm. The first woman who testified was taken to the bridge before any lawyers could make it there. She was denied access to a lawyer. They called our house and said, can you please drive her 3-year-old and her 6-year-old to the bridge so that we can deport the family together? We had a lawyer right there who could get on the phone and say, do not do anything, I'll be right there, and was able to say that she would not accept voluntary departure, that she would go through the court process, and was able to get her out of the immediate deportation. The other witnesses were similarly attended to by lawyers. They were able to come back to our house. But from then on, the Mexican consulate insisted upon driving all of our witnesses to the grand jury hearings so that they wouldn't be at risk of being deported. Vicente Fox actually got involved at one point and wrote a letter to the local Border Patrol saying that if these people weren't given visas, the Mexican government was going to get involved. If the people, the witnesses, weren't given visas to be in the U.S., that wound up not being an issue because during the grand jury hearings, they were relatively safe. They had a number of papers with them that would keep them from being deported. And then the grand jury decided that the man was innocent, that there hadn't been it wasn't a crime what had happened. So everything from there on has put our house in kind of a different state. The day that the murder happened and for the next week or so, there were definite times that Border Patrol helicopters circled our house. And guests of ours were followed by Border Patrol out of the house and deported after being asked, where do you live? Who lives in that house? Who runs that house? Are there undocumented people living in that house? A number of questions. So it really felt like the times were changing, national news and also right there in our house. Everything's gotten much more heightened on the border. People now, I forgot to mention, the other popular way that people travel, because they can't travel on buses or airplanes anymore since September 11th, every ID is checked everywhere. Every bus gets stopped and every single person's information is checked. As long as you're brown, as long as you're not a white person with good English, they check your documents. But there's another method called coyotes, which is a word for people smugglers. It's an illegal trade. People who smuggle individuals across the border and then also within the country. There's a whole network of people smuggling. For about $1,500, people seem to be able to get someone to take them from our house to Florida or to California. It seemed to be around $1,500 to $2,000 to get to New York, $800 to Phoenix. These were illegal. It was illegal activity, but it seemed for our guests to be the safest way for them to travel. It was the one that made us the least scared for their safety. But the coyotes weren't traveling. Since when I left the past few months, people weren't traveling with coyotes either because the border's so much tighter. So things have changed in a lot of ways. And for me, it was really an amazing experience to be there. I felt like I got to welcome people to our country who I felt like ought to be here, people who want to be here to do good work, to be doing good work for their families, to be moving themselves forward in their own lives. I felt like someone asked me before if I felt like what I was doing was immoral because it was against the law, and I pretty much felt like the line that I was walking wasn't against the law. It was definitely a line. We knew that it was a fine line. We didn't get involved in aiding and abetting in any form. We couldn't actually transport people anywhere across the border or within El Paso unless it was to a hospital or social service agency. Conspiracy, if people told me that they were going to be going with a coyote, sometimes they would ask me my opinion on that or ask me which coyote I thought would be a good one. I don't know anything about it. I don't know. You're going to have to work that out yourselves. And the last one was harboring. And I believe that we weren't harboring either. INS knows about us. Our director had monthly meetings with INS to discuss the policies on their reaction to social service agencies. He attended large meetings where they would do sort of informative things about what's going on in the city. And I felt like it was just an amazing experience to get to be right with people. So it was a sad thing to leave, and I'm trying to figure out how to keep it up and keep doing work like that, but I don't know where that'll take me, but it was a good place to be. So I think I was a little nervous at the beginning, and maybe I missed some things, but that's pretty much what I wanted to tell people about. And I wonder if people have questions.
How many years were you doing?
From November 2001 until just now, so about 20 months.
For a family who wants to relocate and just move to the United States from Mexico, like how do they go about doing that? What's the first step?
If you want to do it legally, if you're trying to apply for the correct documentation to do that, the ways right now for a Mexican to get papers to come to the U.S. are either to have a family member in the U.S. who's petitioned for you, like immediate family, spouse, parent of an underage child, or child of the parent, can be petitioned for with a fairly quick time. It takes about a year for someone in the U.S. to petition for that person to come join them. Anything wider than that, any relation wider, like an adult sibling, wider relations, it takes about 9 years for someone to petition for you to come. There's been talk, I don't know if anybody remembers, but in early September 2001, Vicente Fox met with George Bush, or was going to meet, I guess, with Bush about an amnesty law that would create amnesty for, I think they were saying, 2 million undocumented Mexicans living in the U.S. who'd been there for 5 years living undocumented, as undocumented people, that was scrapped after September 11th. But they say right now that there's about 8 million people living in the U.S. With an undocumented status. So if you don't come in through petitioning, I suppose you probably could come in through the ways that people come in from other, if you were very skilled in a very specific industry. But as an unskilled worker, there's really no other way. Basically, a petition or nothing. We did see a lot of VAWA cases. I knew a woman who was violence against women. It's when, let me explain it better. You're married to an American person who will not apply for you. You have to prove that you were with this person for more than 2 years. You have to have statements proving that you were abused by this person and that they refused to petition for you, and it was a way to self-petition. But beyond that, there were very few Mexicans who were getting papers in the U.S. right now.
I've heard people setting up marriage arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
One man I know married numbers of women to get them in the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think people do that. I know that that INS is pretty careful about keeping track of making sure that it's legitimate. I don't know very much about that. I don't know very many people who were coming in that way. But I think it is another way, that's true.
There's also the work permit lottery that takes place in all of our embassies, which is a...
This isn't
you
something
literally
I know
enter the lottery as if you were entering a lottery in the United States. You pay $100 for it. And a certain number of people, for instance, in Guatemala, are allowed to come in on work permits as they win in that lottery.
Wow, I didn't know about that.
So that takes place in most countries.
Huh. That's interesting. I haven't heard anything about that. I wonder if it takes place in Mexico. I wonder. That's interesting.
I don't know about Mexico. In Central America.
Central America, yes.
And in Africa.
Uh-huh.
Do you know where the money from the lottery goes?
Just to support the cost of running the lottery.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Who funds your
organization?
Yeah.
It's all private donations. It's all individuals who have heard about the organization in some way. There have been a few people who left their estates to Annunciation House. There's a lot of churches who make regular donations. Mm-hmm. We don't get any funding from any one denomination, like the Catholic Diocese of El Paso doesn't give us regular funding. It's sort of based on the idea that comes from Dorothy Day with the Catholic Worker Movement, that an organization like ours doesn't want to accept money that might have strings attached to it. Just let people give as they give. We never ask for money. It's all just things that come in. There's sort of an addendum to that, which is that within the last couple of years, we have applied for a few grants, which have been able to pay for, we had $20,000 worth of electric work done a couple of years ago, some things like that, some renovation work. But beyond the big renovation projects, our daily work is all run on individual donations and in-kind donations, food and clothes.
It sounds like they got an economic problem in Mexico. Are they doing anything about it?
Is our organization? Is Mexico?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, a lot of Mexicans definitely talked about how frustrated they are with their own government. I went to a talk given by a priest, a Mexican priest living in Juarez, who says that the average middle to low income Mexican family pays 13% of their annual income in bribes. I don't know that that's true, but I heard it in this talk. There's a lot of lying, what's the word?
Corruption.
And they say, Vicente has some ideas that sound nice on paper, but there's no difference between the political parties. Mexicans have to pay for their own, for public education. There's a fee for a child to enter school. And there is a form of health insurance in Mexico, but you only receive it by working at an established job. And without that, there's virtually no health insurance either. So it's true, for poor people living in Mexico, there's very little safety net.
Did you ever... Did you ever have times when the hospitality was taken advantage of? And how did I would just think that would get difficult to keep bringing people in with that sort of level of trust if that's getting broken. Or like, did that happen regularly, and how did you guys deal with that, I guess?
The most awful time was when a family of 11 came to stay with us, and the guests are very accustomed. It was sort of a four-part family, a couple sisters and their children and the grandmother. The guests are very accustomed to people coming in with donations and lots and lots of large bags coming, being donated to the house. When this family came, there were lots and lots of large bags that were all what they were bringing with them, and the guests helped us bring them inside. And one backpack was taken from that collection and was rifled through without us knowing, and all of their birth certificates and baptismal medallions and personal wedding photos were gone, and we never got them back. And that was awful. We had about 5 meetings that day where we sat everybody down and said, this is ridiculous. We're going to have to think about kicking out the whole house. We can't have things like this happen. We talked to a lot of different people trying to establish what the story had been, who'd seen it happen. It sounded like everybody had kind of had a part in rifling through this stuff. So that was awful. That was really discouraging. It made us more vigilant about our policy that when bags come into the house, they go straight into the office, and that's the last that anybody sees of them until they're separated. But there are certain things that were set up that way, like donations go straight into the volunteer area where they're divided before they're given out. The guests didn't have access to the house's food except during the 3 meals. Sometimes that was loose, sometimes that was too loose, and people's individual food, which we would store for them, got eaten. There were definitely times that were really hard. One way that we found really helped keep things more in check was by having a weekly meeting with the guests. And that was a lot of fun. We got each person to introduce themselves to the group, and we talked about just weekly issues. But for a while, we weren't doing that, and we found that when we did do it, it was easier to assume that people were going to contribute to their chores, to assume that they'd be more willing to volunteer to cook when it was time to look for cooks. But definitely we had trouble with that. Yes?
Did you provide any other services besides food and shelter?
We provided basic social services. If someone came in with a medical problem, there was a nearby homeless clinic that saw any homeless person it was a nurse practitioner, and she would see any homeless person in any of the shelters in El Paso. They were great. They helped our guests through basic things like bronchitis or basic things. There was also an emergency room that by law sees anyone with medical emergencies. So there was a man who came in who slashed his hand really badly on the fence climbing in, and he was seen by the hospital. People were regularly seen by them. We also were able to provide people with basic counseling sometimes. There was a program that had just started up amazingly, since everybody else is cutting their services, but they have a grant to do 3 years worth of counseling to the homeless. That was great. So we tried to do for people what we could in the realm of medical, mental health, education. Kids could be enrolled in school if they were staying with us for a while. It seems like they'd be with us for a little while. Those were the basic services.
Was there a limit to how long someone could stay with you?
Each guest that came was assigned a volunteer, and that volunteer checked in with them regularly, then checked in with all the volunteers once a week, and we tried to make sure that each person was sticking to a pretty specific plan for what they were going to do while they were in our house. Some people would come in and say, oh, I have this great idea, I'm going to make $3,000 while I live at your house, and then I'm going to go back to Mexico. And we'd say, that is not a great idea. That's going to take you a really long time, and why don't you start thinking about getting an apartment in El Paso or doing something else? We can't provide you that much time. So we did deadline guests. We'd give them a specific length of time that they could stay. Like I said, with single people, it was usually less, and with families, it was usually more time. So, there were lots of different things about that. Yeah?
since you've been involved in this, what do you see as a way of making it better for everybody?
I know. It's a big question.
What's your idea?
What's my idea?
What could be done?
I asked our director this a lot, too, because sometimes it was so easy to become so focused on the immediate injustices that our guests were experiencing and not to focus on the wider issues. I agree with what he says about acknowledging that there's a population that comes here. For just as a first place to begin, people come to our country to work here, and we let them come, and we hire them, and we pay them. And that needs to be acknowledged legally. Those people need to have rights in our country. They need to feel safe to call the police when their house is robbed. They need to feel safe to expect fair living wages, to expect safe places to live and work. I think that's a first step. Beyond that, I think in this same speech that I heard the priest give about the 13% of the annual income, he said that he thinks our government needs to be more discriminating about how we work with other governments. We need to consider the fact that the Mexican government doesn't look out for the poorest people in their country and put pressure on them to do that. That's an interesting idea that, I mean, I don't know how that would work, but it's important. It's definitely run by the richest people right now. What's that?
Well, some of the imperialistic elite, they're talking about rich people.
Do you want to repeat that?
Is this about rich people again?
Yeah.
Sound like imperialists there.
You could say that. Yeah.
More for the people, not for the rich elite.
Mm-hmm. It's tricky. I think the most idealistic, most heartfelt answer that I have about it is that I don't think it's right for our world to have borders. I don't think there should be separations between countries and between the way that the world is run, that by being born on one side of an arbitrary line means one thing and being born on the other side means something different. Do you have answers to that? I think it's really a complicated situation.
Well, I read in a paper occasionally where Mr. Fox blamed us for all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's blame for both sides. I think the way that we're doing NAFTA right now is really wrong. I think that we call it free trade, but we subsidize our own farm workers and put billions of dollars into supporting our farm industry, which Mexico and these other countries can't do. There just aren't those billions of dollars, and they aren't doing it also, but they don't have the money to support their farm industries that way. And for that reason, it's so much, we call it free trade because we can freely now sell Kansas corn in Mexico and run out everybody from the system because Kansas corn is so much cheaper than any Oaxacan corn could ever be. So I think the way that we think about globalization is really affecting things badly too. I have another answer to it. There's American factories that have moved to Juarez. They pay $5 a day per worker. I haven't talked about that, but the most unskilled workers in the factories earn $5 a day. That includes some health benefits and some sort of bonuses that got tossed in every so often. But in Mexico, groceries in Juarez cost the exact amount, same amount as they cost in El Paso. It's cost the same amount of money to do grocery shopping in Juarez that it does in El Paso. So single mother families who earn $30 a week for working all day, every day, are trying to use that $30 to buy American-priced groceries and pay for their kids to go to school, pay for medical stuff for their kids, and pay for a place to live. And we had nothing to say to these women. After a while, I mean, our director had already said it a lot of times, and I started to feel the same way. I just don't know how you're going to do it. I don't know how you're going to get by. It became kind of what I would think when people came to our door. Because people can't do it on our side either, undocumented. You earn $80 a week, tops, living in with someone. They don't want your kids to live there. Rent is cheap in El Paso, but it's not that cheap.
The issue is undocumented workers, and wondering about the impact of phony ID, which may sound like a
What did you say, phony?
Phony.
Phony ID.
Fake ID, which may sound like a peripheral matter, but in the population I'm familiar with, it's extremely common. Phony documents.
Where are you from? We're from near here. Near here. Mm-hmm.
We have actually helped a family buy a home with a federally subsidized mortgage, which required U.S. documentation, and their documents wouldn't pass the smell test, mm-hmm. but they got it through anyway.
Wow.
We believe that was the right thing to do because this family is now paying taxes and is becoming a contributing
right.
part of the community. My point is, there's a big impact on this whole problem relating to the existence of phony ID.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you know much about that.
The truth is, I really don't. It's not an issue very much in El Paso. I can only speak of one person who I met, and I probably met 1,000 people during my time there. There's only one that I can think of who, at least up front, told us that he had fake documents. I really don't think very many other people were working with them either, because they would have been earning more money, they would have had more steady jobs if they were able to. I think, I'm guessing that when people get farther into the country, that becomes more of a possibility. I think in El Paso, there's so much Border Patrol presence that creating phony documents and selling them there would be difficult. People come across not really having a sense of needing those or wanting those. It just wasn't as much of an issue, but I've heard it a lot mentioned here since I've been talking about it up north, more in northern places.
Mm-hmm. I don't know who else struggles with this, but it's what you're talking about. It's social ramifications. It's the struggle between the hospitality from human being to human being, mm-hmm. world without borders, charity at its very simplest.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. And there's, yeah, but this is the stand that my government has.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you do as a human being about that? And, I mean, my husband and I spent some time near the Mexican border in Arizona, mm-hmm. in the Anza Borrego area, and that's an area that has anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 illegal aliens coming during the night.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the Border Patrol there is very much concerned with the drug smuggling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, oh, okay, I can get that. And yet my son-in-law, who came legally from Costa Rica, went through the visa, showed that he had this much money. There's always money involved.
Always money.
Yeah. But he had this much money that he, you know, had to take into the States. And everything was on the up and up. And I would say that probably took, because at that time he was married. Well, they're still married, but they had just gotten married, mm-hmm. in Costa Rica.
What year was that?
This was before 9/11, but this, mm-hmm. was in 99. Okay. So, you know, there's that. And then Uncle Armando comes from Costa Rica, who's my son-in-law's uncle, because the whole families, they get connected. And they get connected through the money that they wired down, mm-hmm. through phone calls with the phone cards. And somehow he ended up living at our house, and because it was this hospitality. So we were conscious of the decision we were making, but that was like, okay, we're going to be humans first.
Mm-hmm.
But we're being asked to make a choice between following the law,
mm-hmm.
and contributing to the social ramifications. And what do I do as a human being to a human being, because they want a better life? They're only up here. They're not here because this is just such a great country. They're here to make money and send it home.
Mm-hmm. Because
so
that money's not available.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can go to Yakima and you easily can get a social security number. So there's just, even though they crack those big cases of fake ID, it's just everywhere. And you know, we're wrong to, or in a row, we're ignorant to think this is just an El Paso, we're born thing.
For
it's
sure.
Everywhere.
It's not even just a U.S. problem. I think it's a first world, lots and lots of countries that really struggle with Border Patrol, and not just us. I just want to, just a quick anecdote that the kid who was killed, the 19-year-old, had actually met an American woman while living in El Paso and was hoping to marry her. And they were both very upfront about how they were doing that specifically so that he could get paperwork. And I asked him about that, you know, are you being really upfront with her about this? Like, is that really, you know, what you're saying to her too? And he said, oh, I'm being very upfront, I want her to know that. He said, I want to be an American, I want to have the rights that you have. I don't want to be caught by Border Patrol anymore. I don't want the embarrassment, the humiliation of being here this way. I want to have the rights that you have. And that still comes back to me sometimes. Just, I don't know if it would have if he hadn't been the one who was killed, but it's a pretty strong comment. Did someone read
well,
the next question?
I'm going to sort of lay that against another where, you know, the undocumented people are here and they're sending most of their money back, and yet our taxes are paid for them
mm-hmm.
in very special schools. I mean, I'm talking about right in the state of Washington, right in the Valley.
And I, that,
and
so
you see, you
that is
the
epitome of what I'm talking
about.
I struggle
with
that every day.
So we're paying for that, and yet they're sending all their money back and not paying any tax into the system.
That's not true, they're not paying taxes. If they are earning an income, their employer, which is obviously taking them on with fake ID, is paying federal withholding and Social Security, unemployment.
Which then is
their own document.
You'll never see that.
They can't get a job without documents in the United
States.
They
have to have a Social Security number to get a job.
You can't get a job in the United States without those huge penalties for an employer to be caught,
mm-hmm.
including criminal penalties, for hiring anybody without what appear to be legal documents. And once you have what appear to be legal documents, you are required to withhold all those taxes. So they're actually paying, and interestingly, and I sound like I'm defending them, because I also understand the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, you have people coming in this country working, and their load on our social service system is actually less than American citizens. As
mm-hmm.
on a per capita basis, the illegal aliens in this country actually use less services than the Americans do.
And some is because that's just not provided to them. But I would say most people do not come with the intention of trying to get on welfare or get. I think that most people genuinely do come home for work, but that's a stereotype too. We just get James and you. And I don't actually know what time it is either, but 7:15. Okay. James, what is your question?
So next, government doesn't look up the next citizens.
That's kind of what I'm saying to some degree. I think there are some things that they do provide that are, you know, worthy provisions, but a lot of it, a lot of people come, feel like they can't get by or don't have a safety net because there isn't some sort of thing provided for them.
I asked that question, if I may, when I was down there for a period of time, and in a nutshell, the Social Security system for old people, poor people in Mexico, is selling newspapers and Chiclets gum on the street corners.
Oh, yeah.
That's literally what the system is.
We had a lot of older people come to our house in their 70s hoping to be finding physical labor jobs because their children couldn't support them. There just wasn't much to say to them either.
Is that because Mexico's poor that way?
What's that?
Is it because Mexico is poor that way?
I think it's partly because Mexico's poor and partly because it's pretty corrupt. A lot of the money stays in certain circles and doesn't come to, isn't distributed very well.
Yeah, corruption, they need to be reformed.
Yeah. Let's see what Kate wants to say.
It's more a comment than a question. I wanted to go off what you said, and something that's been really like running through my mind as I've been listening to all these conversations from the spiritual perspective, and I think about Martin Luther King during the sit-in movements, and he was on 60 Minutes, and I like had this image of him from a video clip, and he says that we have a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws,
mm-hmm.
and that the laws that are set forth by our government are often unjust, and that sometimes there's a higher law that we're responsible to.
That was something we thought about a lot.
There's risks in everything. You might end up in a cage.
There was, my mother sent me this because of
Jesus.
That fear.
Changing the subject a little bit, do you know anything about the women that are disappearing? There's been over 100 of them, maybe over 200 by now. The first time I heard about that was up here at Holden several years ago, and those girls are disappearing from
and they're still
Mexico.
Mm-hmm. It's right. It's happening in Juarez. Juarez is the only city that I know of that it's happening in. There's a whole campaign. Ni un mujer menos en Chihuahua. Not one fewer woman in the state of Chihuahua that's going on. There's tons of campaigns that have started just in the past couple of years to teach women basic self-defense techniques. But the story is that young women from the ages of 15 to 20, early 20s, are being kidnapped and killed. There's about 150 to 200 women in the past 8 years. The government's doing very little to investigate it. Shockingly little. They arrested one Egyptian man a few years ago, and they were saying that it was because he was a foreigner and there was something wrong with the way he was seeing the world, and that was why he was doing this, and they put him in jail, but the murders continue. There's rumors all the time about what that is. The biggest theory right now seems to be that it's for organ selling. People say that the police are actually involved.
That would make sense.
There's tons of things that have been said. The FBI has been asked in a couple of cases to come in and actually help Mexico work on those cases, but it's really awful.
It's a triple whammy because a lot of them have small children at home with their mother taking care of the child, and it means the whole thing just is collapsing for that whole group. And
a lot of them work in American factories and have been caught after leaving their factory jobs late in the middle of the night, and that's when they're kidnapped.
Yeah, they get taken.
They get dropped off by the American buses near their houses, and then that's when it happens. Did you have questions for the other group? Well, maybe one more. I don't know what time it is. It's probably almost
time
to stop, right?
I can put a quick word of hope in here.
Yeah, good.
America's a great melting pot. And we're now telling ourselves, many of us, that this problem is different than the German, Italian, Irish, Swedish, and so on immigrants.
It's so different.
And they're saying it's so different, but I'll give you a piece of word of hope. At least it encouraged me in thinking about it. This is the great melting pot. What we hope for is the integration of immigrants in our general society. And one measure of that is the intermarriage rate. As people are married, for example, now who cares whether you're marrying an Irishman or an Italian or a German or whatever. 100 years ago, not so true. If you look at the intermarriage rate for Hispanics with Anglos in the United States, right now, the native Mexican rate is 8%. That is 8% of native Mexicans living in this country marry Anglos. The children of those folks, meaning young people who have been born here in the United States, the intermarriage rate is 33%.
Wow.
And their children, that is now the second generation of people who have now been born and raised in the United States, the intermarriage rate is 66%.
Wow.
Okay? So maybe, you know, not in our lifetimes, but certainly in our children's lifetimes, many of these problems
and
may
hopefully take away. We'll think of a different way of conceiving of the border. Hopefully that'll happen. So anyway, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.